Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent headline news and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical application that you can take back to the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
The article is Amazon plans to track worker keystrokes, a sign of controls to come. And this comes from ThreatPost. So Amazon is considering rolling out keystroke monitoring for its customer service reps because in a memo leaked from Amazon, they say that their customer service credentials are being abused and data theft is on the rise. And within this article, or within the memo, I'm sorry, from that Amazon distributed internally, they said, we don't have a reliable mechanism for verifying that users are who they claim they are. And this is leading, well, that's the end quote. And then this is leading to high data exfiltration risk. And some of the examples which were stated in there were employees working from home in countries like India and the Philippines, where most of these security events occur, with roommates using legitimate customer service reps credentials to look up the accounts of famous people to see what they bought from Amazon, hackers buying customer service rep credentials, and using USB rubber ducky.
How much is an Amazon account rep's account worth? I'm actually super curious about this.
I don't know, because I'm not sure exactly what actions an account rep can take, because really, I think it would depend on what actions they can take or what data they have access to as far as what the value of that customer service rep's account is. Because the attackers who are going to pay for it want some kind of return on investment.
Yeah, unless it's, you know, somebody trying to check out what Lady Gaga purchased in her last, you know, monthly shipment from Amazon Prime or whatever. So I can go into tabloids. I don't see a ton of financial value there. Maybe blackmail value. Maybe you can look up people and see if they bought that 60-gallon giant blue barrel of inappropriate adult product.
Or that book they shouldn't read.
Yeah. Actually, you know what though? That, I wonder if they can search by product and see who bought a product. If you find a particularly embarrassing product.
Oh, and then search for a list of customers who have purchased it.
And since you're in the system, you can probably see their accounts and their, you know, email and address.
I'm sure that's in the data. I just don't know who would have, if customer service reps would have access to it. Because I'm trying to think of, if they're customer service reps, then they're interacting with customers to help the customers out.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how that helps customer if, you know, having access to that data.
Well, I'm going to call and I'm going to ask them what James Franco bought this week and see if they can help me out. Yeah. So I guess the other part of this and seems, and then we'll talk later about, but like part of it seems like a least privilege issue maybe, but maybe they should pay the Amazon account reps more. If people are purchasing customer service credentials and their roommates are using their account, maybe they should pay them a little bit more. It's kind of like cops. If you're paying a cop a little bit of money, then they're more tempted by bribes. But I don't know if that actually solves this problem.
Well, that's assuming that the customer reps themselves are selling the accounts versus the accounts are simply being compromised and being sold.
Yeah, but that's the same. That's the same problem you have for all accounts. That's not an Amazon specific problem. So I was looking for like a solution that's Amazon specific.
Right.
So, I guess. And the other thing here, the USB rubber ducky. For you to use a rubber ducky, you have to have physical access to the system. So why is this being called out as a specific issue? I guess, is this a big problem where people know that it's Amazon, or is this kind of like you were talking about a second ago, where it's just a generic problem where people are physically breaking in and then they just happen to have a rubber ducky as well to break into whatever company the person's whose physical location they're breaking into works for? That seems really convoluted.
Yeah, I think it's more insider threat focused. That the customer service reps themselves are using the rubber duckies.
That's interesting. I wonder if they're using them to actually break into stock, or they're using them to like automate their normal day to day. You wouldn't really need a. See, the thing is you really don't really need a rubber ducky if you're a legitimate user. If you're a legitimate user, although maybe they've got application whitelisting, so you can't just install like macro programs.
I'm not sure because they didn't give any examples exactly how the rubber duck is being used.
Yeah, that's such a weird call out though. So, because that is, I mean, that's always one of the things we talk about, right? Where your threat model of a physical attacker doesn't necessarily overlap with the threat model of a computer attacker. You know, people that are breaking into your offices are usually there to steal things. They're not there to, you know, log into the system and do bad things programmatically. So, or at least not for, you know, outsourced people working at home, because then you've got to do a lot of effort to figure out, you know, who do they work for? Where are the Amazon workers in this area, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. It's easier to actually just break in remotely than it is to break in physically and add, you know, and then use a technological attack.
It just seems so weird, but maybe it happened like one time and they're using it as an example as to why. Maybe they're like you were talking about before, justifying a purchase.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, they had all these different scenarios and then they just plucked, you know, well, what's the worst one? Or what's the most dangerous one or something like that, and put, you know, put that on the list. So they actually called out in the article, the software, which Amazon is proposed to be using, which is called BehavioSec.
It's a terrible name. They should have just left the R in there. BehavioSec, fine. BehavioSec, dumb.
Yeah. I agree. Because then people like me have a hard time pronouncing it, which apparently aggregates the data of users' mouse clicks and keystrokes to develop a profile of their behavior. So basically, it baselines user behavior. Yeah. So probably got AI and ML, you know, in there doing this thing.
So you have to buy it. No, this is, I've seen definitely seen articles on this before where it's biometrics, like they talk about every person types differently and stuff like that. But that's a little different than monitoring all keys. At least that's a little different than what I think of when I hear people talking about monitoring all keystrokes.
Well, since they're talking about mouse clicks and keystrokes, maybe, you know, this is actually a little bit different than key logging. So it's not, maybe not the key, maybe it's like metadata about the keystroke and not the key itself. So you hit A 2 seconds after you hit B, 4 seconds after you hit C, you know, it's the relative speed, pressure, you know, those kind of things about the keystrokes and not the actual keys themselves, maybe.
Yeah. And that becomes a lot less offensive, I think, if you're just, you know, the typical, you know, difference between hitting R and T because of the way you hold your hands is definitely, I think, less than, you know, keeping track of, you visited all these sites, you typed in all these things. Ugh, right. Passwords would end up in there if they're tracking all the keystrokes too. That when an attacker gets on there, that makes things a little easier. Huh?
I guess one of the questions you have, if that is actually the way that the software works, is a $10 keyboard provide the details necessary? You know, in order to get that data, or are they going to have to roll out all new keyboards for everybody?
Yeah, they probably doesn't go that far. Probably just does like timing, like you said, because that should be able to come through no matter what keyboard you're using.
But that would be an interesting idea, though, to have a high-end keyboard that has a lot of different metadata about your typing, which is included in the transmission to the computer, that can be leveraged for future biometrics or stuff like that, where the keyboard you have is part of your authentication mechanism because of the metadata that's transmitted with your login about how you typed it.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
So I think, you know, that kind of monitoring would probably be successful against, you know, the attacker who bought credentials, but I don't think it'd be very good against the malicious insider, at least if they understood exactly the gist behind how, you know, UBA type stuff works, because all they'd have to do is re-baseline their activity so that whenever they conducted their attack, it just stayed under the radar within the baseline.
Yeah, that's an attack I've never seen, but I don't know if that's just because I've just missed it in the past, or maybe I've never worked anywhere where there's been UBA properly baselined, or I don't know, how long does UBA take to baseline? Like, do you change your behavior over a day, or do you have to change your behavior over a week, or what?
I think it really depends on the UBA, because they may baseline the initial 30 days of rollout and never baseline again.
That sounds like a re-baseline.
Or maybe they re-baseline, you know, every 90 days, or maybe what happens is you are baselined, you conduct an activity that's outside baseline, you get put into an incident, it gets investigated and adjudicated, and then it says, oh, well, no, that's a change to this user's baseline. So they either re-baseline that user based on that event or something along those lines. So not sure, really depends. But if they are actually capturing keystrokes, I wonder if this could be used to actually track users or track employees.
Yeah. Yeah. He had a quote in here where he said keystroke monitoring is the kind of security that remote employees will have to get used to in the future. I can see a world where this becomes standard for sure.
I think it becomes standard for certain companies, but not others, or certain remote workers and not others. Where, you know, if you have a small technically capable organization, let's say you have a small software development company and all your workers are remote, I don't think this is the kind of thing that they would be using.
Yeah.
But a large company that Amazon has, that has a large distributed workforce of, this is probably going to be a bad way to put it, but commodity, tasks or employee roles, like customer service reps.
Yeah, this is
where this is going to happen.
Yeah, this is like all those retail places where, you know, you have to work every minute that you're there. You're being paid by the hour. You know, if you're lean and you got time for cleaning and all the stuff that they use, it's that same kind of commodity level, dehumanizing type of job where you're a cog in a wheel and they can hire somebody else to replace you. So, I mean, the only good part here is it's way too much data to actually examine for these companies, at least individually, until you're going to get some C-level or some hotshot manager is going to get the idea of tracking active time, especially for a customer service rep or something. They do this with the reps on the phone, where you have to spend so many minutes on the phone and you've got to get a good rating everywhere. They're going to be watching your keystrokes and be like, you know, you must maintain 80% active time on the keyboard with less than 10 seconds between keystrokes. Then you're going to see some rubber duckies come in. They're going to come in and just hit space or shift every 8 seconds or whatever.
Man, then you have to check a box saying going to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Or something like that. I don't know. I think that might work for, you know, remote workers in like India or the Philippines. I don't think Americans would go for that.
I think a lot of Americans would have to. They have to suck it up.
I don't know. I have to see. I think, you know, if there's a large enough complaint, if there are large enough complaints or enough pushback, I think they'd, I don't think that would fly.
I can see it, and I guarantee you it's going to be Amazon or Walmart that starts it.
All right. We'll see.
Take a bet. Yeah.
All right. So why is this important? So the question that I was kind of asking myself when I was reading this article was, you know, are they trying to protect the organization from employees' abuse of data or the employees' ability to access data? So are they abusing the data they have access to, or are they getting access to data they don't have access to?
Yeah, there's this quote from Gaurav Banga, CEO of Balbix, where he says, the most basic security control in any organization is the employee manager, he explained. I don't disagree with that part. The manager knows who the employees are, what they're supposed to be doing, how they're supposed to be doing it. Again, no problem with that statement. Once employees started working from home offices, that most basic security control was lost. What the actual hell?
That does not make any sense unless you are sitting at every employee's desk, watching them all the time when you're in the office.
Yeah, you can't set up for everybody and make sure they're going to the right site and accessing the right information. Although, remember what we were just talking about a minute ago. Once you're in kind of that dehumanized commodity level job, you are expected to act kind of like a robot and a cog in the machine, where you are only supposed to do, you know, what the company wants you to at the speed the company tells you to.
Yeah, but in the office, managers aren't physically doing that all the time.
No, but this kind of snap, and I brought this up before, and I'll bring this up again. This reminds me of when I worked at a grocery store. I was a cashier, and it was, if you're not checking people out, you're fronting the merchandise. If you're not fronting the merchandise, you're cleaning your belt, you're cleaning your station. If you're not doing that, you're picking up carts. Like, the whole goal was to maximize every minute of your time, where you are never sitting alone, never not doing things. And that's what this smacks to me of. And you talked about it yourself, like the commodity level employee. This is not for high level employees. This is not for senior programmers. This is not for engineers. This is for people that are making, you know, $5 an hour, $4 an hour, and doing customer service tasks. And it sucks for them.
Right. So this is one of those situations where, you know, what is a security control, or at least starts off as security control, starts turning into an HR/productivity control.
Yeah, proxies fall into this. You know, they started off as a method of controlling access to malicious websites, bad websites, and now, you know, HR managers are like, give me a list of all the websites this person visited during this period of time. EDR controls can do the same thing. They start off as protective, and then some managers start asking for what programs are being run by people. So security is not supposed to be the fun police. But yeah, we can be used that way.
Right. And it's really incumbent on, you know, security leadership to push back on those kinds of requests, saying, you know, this is not what the tool is designed for. You know, this is not its purpose here. All right. So what you can do about this. So I was thinking, based on, you know, the scenarios that they put forth and the capabilities of that tool, is whether MFA and, you know, timeouts could be used instead of this behavior control to ensure that the employee's login is who they say they are. As you know, mentioned in the memo, was that they had no way of validating that users are who they claim to be. So MFA should be able to stop that. And if you have, you know, login timeouts that, you know, forces a user after so much inactivity to be booted from the system where they have to log back in, I think that could be a potential mechanism that they could use in lieu of the keystroke monitoring, at least for that use case of verifying a user is who they say they are.
Yeah, the whole roommates thing, if people would actually lock their systems as they walk away.
Right. Yeah, actually, worked with a guy who, I can't remember where he said he was working at, but they had two-factor login to their computers, which was a badge. And if your badge was so far away from your computer, I'm not sure if it was IR or RFID or what, but once the badge was so far away from the computer would lock automatically based on the distance.
I mean, I lock my computer whenever I walk away from it at home, but that's because I have kids and I don't want them to get on my computer.
Right. I mean, if you're in a, you know, insecure environment, quote unquote, which means there's more than one person near your computer or can be near your computer, certainly should be doing the standard security mechanisms, locking it and all that. But the question is, you know, if you're concerned with data access or data exfil or both, then there are different mechanisms to protect against either of those. So data access, the basic thing there is, you know, least privilege. Ensure that, you know, users only have access to the data that they're supposed to have access to. And if they only need that access infrequently, maybe we'd be better to deny them that access or monitor that access so that they only are accessing the data when it's really necessary for them to do so.
Yeah, I mean, this almost makes me think of like the privileged access management solutions, where you kind of get the credentials ad hoc or a la minute, and it doesn't monitor your keystrokes, but monitors your use of those credentials. It'd be interesting if there was a ticketing system that allowed you access to whatever the ticket you're working on is. So for example, you get a ticket, you put in the user's name or account, and boom, now you've got access to all their information. So
right. So there, I think there are ways to do this with existing controls or different controls that don't require the keystroke monitoring. And I think if you're faced with this scenario, you might want to consider what controls you have in your environment and whether they are truly inadequate to deal with this situation, or if they have not been implemented or you're not using them to the best extent in order to minimize this before considering getting a UBA for this purpose or some other fancy tool. Because those things are typically complex, difficult to implement, and expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are going to implement this type of thing, ensure that your privacy policy is clear and the employees have to acknowledge that they've read it.
Yeah. I mean, it's not going to stop the dishonest ones, but at least it's going to stop those mistakes.
Yeah. I mean, HR will have that checkbox
yeah.
for when it becomes or if it becomes a problem.
Yeah. So this
and that privacy policy should make clear that, you know, any personal activity you conduct on a work computer could be monitored. And that should hopefully incentivize people not to do personal things on work computers.
Yeah, that idiot CEO. Oh, I'm sorry, I should say that out loud. That CEO of Bulbix was right when he said, don't do anything personal on a work computer. Even a broken clock can be right twice a day. But yeah, if you don't, work computers are heavily monitored frequently. You know, they might check your proxy going out, even on a VPN, they can watch all your network traffic. You may have AV and EDR, they can really dig into your stuff if you want to. I have seen very silly things done. And actually one of the big concerns for myself is Chrome. Chrome syncs all of your history and all of your bookmarks. You may want to consider getting a separate work account for Chrome so that you don't have any personal stuff. I have seen in the past where people's personal bookmarks have been synced, and it is not terribly appropriate. So.
Oh.
Yeah, that's no bueno. I learned way too much about that person that I did not want to know. All right. We saw an article on a new technique that attackers are using. Attackers are starting to use CAPTCHA pages to hide their phishing and their malware. This is another Threat Post article. I actually misread this one at first. So what it is they're just using real legitimate CAPTCHAs as gatekeepers to the malicious URL. So you go through the CAPTCHA and then you're at the malicious URL. I initially, when I read this, I thought that the CAPTCHA was the malicious URL. Like as soon as you hit the button or whatever, then it would deliver the malware to your system but no, because everybody's, you know, at this point in time, when you see a CAPTCHA, you just fill it out and you go, you don't really think about it. But no, they're showing CAPTCHA pages. And they may do this if they suspect automation based on your IP or browser version. It's not exactly a new technique according to this article, although I'll admit in 10 years or so, I have never seen it personally. But they're seeing an increasing number of these. For example, when the article was written, they saw 529 new CAPTCHA protected malicious URLs per day. It's a very specific number. And they've been detecting them because the attackers are reusing the CAPTCHA API keys, which can be found in the page's HTML. That's interesting. I wonder if that can be turned into a detection mechanism down the road. Anyways, why does this matter? It's pretty simple. Basically, a lot of people assume when you see a CAPTCHA that things are legitimate and you can proceed, because we typically only see them on legitimate sites. This is just a warning that you should not automatically assume it's benign if there's CAPTCHA involved. Maybe worth sending a note to employees or at least letting your IR team know that this is a big thing.
Yeah, and depending on if you're what automated tools you're using, if you are using automated tools to check malicious URLs, that you know running into a CAPTCHA may you know give you a incorrect answer for that automated tool, either saying you know it's not malicious or just a failure for that check.
All right, we have a bonus article for you this week. As I mentioned earlier, our timing, we ended up deep diving into one article and running way over on our time. So to make it work out, we split off some of the other articles we wanted to talk about. And now we find that we don't have quite enough time on this episode. So we saw this really interesting article from Krebs called Wanted: Disgruntled Employees to Deploy Ransomware. And they have an email that was sent out to someone at some company somewhere offering that if you could install and launch the Demonware ransomware on any company computer Windows server, they'll give you 40% of the $1 million ransom. So it turns out that unfortunately this particular scammer was an amateur. He was trying to build up initial money for a social network he's building, but I thought that this was just a really interesting methodology, because cyber criminals trolling for disgruntled employees is going to be really, I don't know. There are a number of other, they provide as an example here, Black Matter ransomware gang has kicked off its presence on forums where they've created a thread where they're asking about access and they want to buy access to networks. So a couple of quick things come to mind. So first of all, if an attacker gets access to your network through you, do they provide you with cover? Do they just give you the installer and tell you to run this installer, or do they send you the phishing email for you to click on, or what? I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
That's got to be the best way. But I mean, if they're any good at this at all, though, you won't be the only one to get that phishing email.
No.
Because if they're really smart, what they'll do is they'll send it to 40 people. You'll be included in there.
I don't know, though.
You'll be the guarantee click.
Oh, the phishing email.
Not but
the
if someone else clicks.
Right. Yeah, because I was saying, if you send the offer email, then that becomes super easy to track down, you know, because just one person needs to report that as phishing. And then they pull everybody that got the offer email and they're like, that's weird. This person who got an offer email clicked on a phishing email a day later.
Yeah, I think it would be a mistake to actually send that that offer email to a business email account. Gotcha. It'd be much better to find them on LinkedIn or something and send it to them via LinkedIn. You know, their personal email address on LinkedIn or something.
I mean, this is just gig work, right?
If they send, yeah, exactly. But if they send that phishing email to 40 recipients, including their partner, then they have at least one guaranteed click. Yeah. This is what I would do if I were the attacker, though. I'd get this guy, send him that email, send it to 40 other people. He would be our guaranteed install. He'd install it. He'd come to claim his money from us. And then we'd be like, yeah, I know that's what we said, but we sent that email to other people. And someone else installed it faster than you. So you're out.
Dang.
You lose your bonus.
Yeah.
Because this is where that Yelp for ransomware crews would be really beneficial, because then you could go on and put on the Yelp review for that guy that he cheated you out of your commission.
I mean, you're not wrong. Like, how do you know that you can even trust that they'll do this? A lot of the ransomware gangs have proven to be at least fairly trustworthy in terms of getting you the key after the fact. But
yeah, they have to have some kind of reputation there. But the thing is, with this kind of scam, though, if you fall for it and you say, oh, I'm going to get that 40%, that's, you know, $400,000. That's a good chunk of change. And they fail to pay you. I mean, not only are you not going to go to the cops, but you have no presence in the dark web to influence their reputation within the ransomware ecosystem either.
I mean, that's true if they reached out to you, but if you got onto those dark web forums, and you know, you publicly posted in their thread saying, hey, I'll give you access. You do at least have potentially that option of flagging them to other people saying, hey, nobody else listens to this guy.
That's true. Yeah. If you're going out there as an independent contractor, versus them soliciting you, then sure, you have something.
I mean, this sounds like the next, venture capital idea, right? We need to create a social network for people that are willing to backstab and blow their employers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you read, you know, trade publications or whatever, you can probably identify companies that have a lot of disgruntled employees.
Mm. Yeah, it sounds like Amazon's got a problem with that, right?
It could be. So there are mechanisms to find, you know, increase your success rate in identifying those who are going to help out or are willing to take that job.
Yeah, I wonder how many people, like, is it even $400,000, 40% of $1 million bounty? That's a big chunk of change. That's enough to make a lot of people consider doing something like this, if they can provide any guarantees at all of, you know, making sure it doesn't come back to you. I guess the real problem here is finding those people. Because again, you can't send out the generic email to everybody. Or I guess you could, as long as you send it out to literally everyone in the company.
Right. Well, actually, this kind of reminds me of an article from years ago. I'm trying to remember which company it was and what the details were, but there was like Cisco or Amazon or Google or something. I think it was Google maybe, had a nation state offer one of their employees $1 million to get a foothold in the network. I think it was Google.
That wouldn't surprise me, especially if it was China. Because there was that big hacking operation that came out, what, 10 years ago now?
Actually, now that I think about it, this kind of thing would probably only be done by, you know, an unsophisticated attacker, because sophisticated attacker is going to buy their access from an access broker and not need to worry about giving a commission to some Joe Blow.
Yeah, but this kind of reminds me of what was that old joke or some old cartoon about you know, we've made this the most secure system ever, you know, it's got such and such encryption and can't be accessed or whatever, and then they talk about just, you know, beating up some guy to get the key or the password, or paying some guy for the password instead of breaking through all the stuff.
No, that's an XKCD comic.
There's an XKCD for everything.
Yeah. And guy says, oh, well, I'm going to sit here and break through this encryption. And the other guy says, okay, well, I'm going to hit the guy with a wrench until he gives me the password.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of. But this seems kind of like that too. I agree with your point that at this point in time, it's so easy to break into companies that it's not necessary. But I could definitely see it, especially if the world seems to keep going the way it is, where this goes back to that Amazon discussion about dehumanizing jobs. You know, a Target employee that makes $15 an hour and is ordered around all day, and somebody's like, hey, you want to help me out? I'll pay you, you know, $100,000 and just plug this thumb drive into your payment system, your register or whatever. I don't know if they actually have thumb drives, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this could be useful to target a specific company you just can't seem to get access to.
Yeah, although I guess probably retail places, it's almost just as easy to walk in holding a toolbox and a, you know, like a multimeter and some work clothes and just plug it in yourself. So.
Yeah, or just walk past an unattended register and stick the thumb drive in it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm probably overthinking this. You're probably right. This is probably not actually all that useful, except in that one case of, you know, a highly, highly, highly secure, specific company that you need to get access to for some reason.
Yeah. But if they're that secure, the likelihood of them having a disgruntled employee that's willing to do this might be low too. So there are other types of challenges here.
Yeah. Just got to find your Dennis Nedry, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. Took me a second, but I got it.
No worries. All right. Do you have anything else to say about that?
I do not.
Awesome. I just want to put it out there that if somebody wants to give me $1 million for access to my company, then I definitely wouldn't do that, especially if my boss is listening. 100% would not do that.
Oh, absolutely not. Well, by the way, my email address is in the show notes.
All right. Well, that looks like that's all the articles we have today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.